Blog Talk Radio.
Another episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio with your hosts Doug, Lyle, and Jan Burke. Today's show is called FBI Agents. What do these guys do? With special guest retired FBI agent, now director of security for ESPN, George Fong. And now, here are your hosts of today's show, Doug, Lyle, and Jan Burke.
Thank you, John. Today we have a special show. Jan and I are both here, and we want to chat with George Fong, a retired special agent for the FBI. And by way of disclosure, George is a good buddy, and we've knocked back more than one or two bourbons together. George spent 27 years with the FBI, though how they tolerated him I'll never understand. And he was involved in all kinds of stuff. I mean, white-collar crime, counterintelligence, bank robberies, drug trafficking, violent crimes, undercover stuff, you name it. George has run the gambit of what FBI agents do. And now he has, without a doubt, my dream job. He's director of security for ESPN. So without further ado, George, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Doug. Jan, I appreciate it.
Well, welcome, George, and don't worry about that bourbon business. If we had to eliminate everybody that had gone drinking with Doug Lau, even his co-host wouldn't be here.
Even the co-host wouldn't
be here. We use that as more of a pre-interview technique with Doug, so we got a lot of interest.
Exactly.
Plus, George, in the real world, I mean, we see a lot of fictional portrayals of FBI agents, everything from the X-Files on. What does an FBI agent do in the real world?
Well, I tell you, Jay, when you look at all the television shows that are out there, some have a bit of truth, some don't. We would love to believe that we can do everything that they say on television, but unfortunately, it isn't quite that accurate. But, you know, agents, federal agents, we're a little bit of a different breed. We still consider ourselves cops, although if you talk to a lot of police officers, they like to take a shot at you every once in a while, in good fun, to say that we're not quite cops. But, you know, we all are part of the same family, cut from the same cloth. But agents are kind of this, a little bit different than what a local cop might do, depending on the jurisdiction. But we all work, the bottom line is we all work investigations, whether that's criminal investigation, counterterrorism, foreign counterintelligence, or cyber. We all, no matter what we do, at the end of the day, you sit back and you support any case investigation to neutralize any kind of risk factor or stop a crime or put people in jail for any kind of violent act. And that's what you do pretty much every single day, you know, in your 20-year-plus career. As a special agent.
So what kind of characteristics make the best agents?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And I think if you ask anyone in any business, they all kind of tell you the same thing. You know, you're looking for the team player. You're looking for leadership. You're looking for all kinds of that stuff. I managed throughout my career, after I finished up, after 19 years of working cases and working the undercover program, I became the supervisor of the violent crime squad in Sacramento and then transferred up, promoted up to a unit chief for the Safe Streets and Gang Unit, managing the entire gang program for the FBI. And every one of those, you get to see the difference in people's personalities. Everyone's traits are different when it comes to how they would react, but they're all very much methodical in their ways of thinking. They may just take a different path. When you talk about in any business, when you got a good person that you're looking for, you always want someone that, personally, you can reach out and you'd have to hold back, rein back them from being aggressive in what they want to do. They have a sense of urgency about them versus having to kick them in the rear end to kind of push them along. Agents are very typically are that. They're type A personalities. They get into trouble probably in their younger days. A lot of us, you know, we could have taken a left as opposed to take a right and, and been on the other side of the track. But because of our, I think, of thinking outside the box, our ability or willingness to take a chance and knowing where that edge is to, you know, meet your objective, that really what makes a really good agent. It makes it kind of an interesting one. They can be a real troublesome to manage, but in the end, it really does pay off.
Well, back before you got into this, obviously you had some preconceived notion of what it was going to be to join the FBI and do that kind of work. But when you actually walked through the door and put on the badge, you know, you got the shield and all that, what surprised you the most, or what were you not expecting and things that you thought, wow, this isn't what I thought was going to happen?
You know, Doug, that's something that I think had always been something that I've carried along with me, because people, first off, people kept always saying to me, says, you don't fit the profile of an FBI agent, and I don't, I admit it. You know, there's parts of you that people stereotype about law enforcement officers, and when you don't carry that trait for it, it kind of throws everyone back. So when I was very young, I got in the FBI at the age of 23, graduated from the academy, the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, 24. That's about as young as you can get in. Mm. And back then, back in 1983, the FBI took primary jurisdiction in drug trafficking investigations, and in specific, you know, the attacking money laundering operations in the United States. So they look for guys like me, dangerous accountants, people who got their degree in holding on to a number two pencil. And so I thought, well, what a wonderful idea. I mean, I thought it would be an interesting career, but I'll be honest with you, I had no idea what an FBI agent really did or what they did. I just knew it was intriguing. You got to do investigations, but that word investigation really takes on a different meaning once you get into it. After 16 weeks at Quantico, they handed me a badge and a gun, and I looked at this thing, and I'm like, what do I do with this? And they gave me a letter. They sent me to Seattle to work white-collar crime matters. And the day I landed, I walked right into an extortion case. A guy threatened to blow up a railroad track and a railroad station if he wasn't paid $500,000. And we went right into chasing him down the middle of Seattle, trying to capture this guy, which we did. And it was a wild ride ever since. I think I stayed in white collar for about, throughout my entire career, a couple of years, but I always had that urge to go over to some of the other criminal matters, which kidnappings and bank robberies, drug trafficking, all the stuff that you kind of dreamed of. And I got hooked up with a really good mentor. We called him the Weasel, and he was a phenomenal agent. So we all had nicknames. And the Weasel said, George, you know, you can't sit around and wait for something to happen. You got to ask. So we got a kidnapping case immediately. And I just jumped in and said, I want to play. And so the older agents, we referred to as the dinosaurs, they grabbed me up and took me aboard. And like I said, it's just been a wild ride ever since.
So how did being part of all of that change you in your life? It sounds like you started from a very different sort of background, if you're saying with the number two pencil. So what are some of the ways that changed your life?
Well, you know, and that's a good point, because you brought up that I came in very young. The pro side of that is that when I got in the FBI, I was finishing up college. I was working full-time during the day, going to school full-time at night. I had gotten married. I graduated. I got in the FBI. And so my life really kind of formulated around my whole career of being in the FBI. And, you know, everyone has differences on how they perceive a job or what they do in life. But I think I can safely say that most FBI agents, what we do is not a job. It's more of a career. It's more of a lifestyle. And no matter what you do, you can say a lot of stuff about going home at the end of the day or doing something with your kids or going to the playground. But everything you do, everything you say, every person you meet, you still are an FBI agent. I think the part of you always comes out, whether it be how you talk, how you stand, how you're perceived by everyone else. And that was what affected me. I think that's what changed me the most. I don't think I ever stepped away from knowing, consciously knowing, that I still carried a badge. And, you know, you hate to kind of over-dramatize, but, you know, you're there to do things, to help support, to help fight for those that can't fight for themselves. And it's just a kind of a cool feeling. And at a young age, when you have that kind of that vision and you carry that forward from your life, I think it does affect on how you deal with your friends or your family or everyone else in life. And no matter what you do at the end, when you do retire, I think the greatest part of that is when you reflect back on it, it's all the stories that you have of what you did right. Again, you did a lot of wrong things too. My family took a huge beating over my time, but it was, I think that you can just feel really proud about the things that you've done over the course of a life, not just a job, but a career.
That's great. That's great. That's good stuff. And let's talk about the job. What kind of cases, you know, local cases, you know, I understand if it's a big federal case, but what kind of local cases are the FBI called in for, and how exactly are agents called in? I mean, who picks up the phone and says, hey, you know, George, we need your help? How does that work?
Right. The FBI has jurisdiction over hundreds of federal violations, mostly in the area of Title 18 and Title 21 violations. Those are your primary federal crimes. Federal law does not have laws such as murder on their books. We piggyback on state and local crimes as what we refer to as predicate violations in support of a federal violation. So, like you and I had talked about many times at Book Passage, you know, you'll have a murder, but someone crossed state lines to commit it. That's a federal violation on a state law. You travel across states to commit a murder. That's a violation of the ITAR law. Everything has a mixture between federal and state laws. When it comes to local crimes, state violations or local violations such as murder, burglary, bank robbery, even fraud matters, anything like that, the FBI can get involved simply by two ways. One is that if it is a predicate violation involving an organized group, as an example, a gang, okay, so you've got a violent street gang, and their predicate violation is that they're committing robberies between here and Nevada, or you're sending checks, or they're committing internet fraud, things like that. Anything that has a predicated violation to an organized group can be a racketeering violation or RICO laws, a violation of the RICO laws. The other one, of course, on local violations is if the local authorities do not have the resources or don't have the ability, technological ability, to address a particular type of chronic crime. So you'll have, pawn shop robberies, but it's involved with maybe some organized group of guys in the area, and it's become a big issue. All they have to do is call us and request our assistance. I used to sit at home when I was working the Violent Crime Squad, and I would read the newspaper on Sunday, actually real paper, newspaper, not just the internet. Yeah, and this shows your age, right? And I would scan it for local crimes. And I would look at them and go, wait a minute here, this is something that we can help these people solve. In particular, we had a girl that there was an attempted kidnapping of a girl, and she was like 8 years old. She escaped. And it said that they had kind of a drawing of this guy, but they couldn't find him. Well, I immediately called up the local authorities and said, listen, you know, let us help you. And so I took out a crew of agents. We went on over there, and within 24 hours, we had the guy identified and arrested. These are things that, you know, we work in conjunction with state and local agencies, and if they need our help, we're there for them.
Cool. Well, on a corollary to that, Are there any cases that the FBI must be called in on? In other words, if the local authorities refuse, neglect, or don't, that they could then
right.
be in trouble?
Right. There are a lot of cases where there's cross-jurisdictional designations between a lot of federal and state agencies. And so, you know, we all have an ability to provide support one way or another. The one type of cases that is probably of the highest priority to the FBI and to the Department of Justice fall in the area of civil rights and public corruption. The FBI still has primary jurisdiction across all federal agencies with regards to public corruption matters. So if there are corrupt public officials and there is some indication that the local authorities is not addressing it, the FBI can step on in and conduct its own investigation. Now, again, that's a very broad statement. That typically does not happen. We really find that any kind of collaborative effort with state and local agencies is the best way. They have strengths that we don't have, and we have ours as well. And so, but public corruption and civil rights matters is mandated for us to be involved in, and we have certain time limitations, constraints that we have to fall into to ensure that we answer to Congress that we are addressing those matters. The other ones, of course, is terrorism matters, counterterrorism, domestic terrorism matters. We do have primary jurisdiction in those assets because we have, or in those investigations because we have resources both domestic and international. And we have something like 69 or 70 legal attaché offices, also known as LEGAT offices, that work directly hand-in-hand with the State Department throughout the world. These are where agents are assigned outside the country, some with more jurisdictional authority than others. But we work very close with the State Department and with our U.S. intelligence partners in ensuring that any kind of threats, terrorist threats that are being emanated from outside the country, is filtered back into the U.S. for us to evaluate and assess for any kind of problems. Those can become very, as you know, it's from all the things, all the conversations that have been going on, can be a real critical area. I always said, not to kind of digress a bit on this, but when we talk about those types of investigations, whether they're civil rights matters or public corruptions where they really affect people, and of course terrorism matters, we always say to ourselves that the decisions that we make are so critical. And not to put down anyone who has a job that makes widgets or makes a product or do any of that stuff. If you don't meet your numbers, it's a bad thing. Man, ESPN looks at ratings. If it doesn't make the ratings number, it's not a good thing. But in law enforcement and what we do in the FBI and look, any of us in law enforcement actually, is that the decision we make, if they go bad or if we make the wrong decision in a split second, or the decision that's made that you're just looking for the right answer but you may have turned the wrong way, is looked at and perceived and second-guessed all the way through Sunday, and it becomes a real demoralizing component. And I guess going back to a characteristic of an agent is that you just got to pick yourself up, brush yourself off, and move along. We understand that, we accept it, we take that burden through our career.
That's quite an emotional burden to be carrying. So we've talked about some of the things that you're likely to be involved in. Are there things that the FBI is unlikely to be involved in, a type of case that's really sort of, I'm not going to say never, but it's really
yeah.
not the sort of thing that they would normally be called in on? I'm thinking also just kind of referring to something you said a moment ago, that I think, for example, people sometimes really assume that there'll always be the FBI involvement in a kidnap.
Right.
But I guess that's not always true. So are there what would make it unlikely? I guess I'll go back to that.
Okay. Well, and you brought up 2 points on that. Then let me address the one about not getting involved. There's a lot of matters that we don't get involved in. Any misdemeanor cases, we typically do not deal with misdemeanor matters. That's the first thing. Now, there are federal crimes that are misdemeanors as well. Those are special jurisdictional cases. That's when crimes occur on federal land, Indian reservations, and there's specific rules on that as well. Overseas, where American citizens are affected, there are certain rules that kind of come into play, crimes on the high seas. But locally, in general, when you read stories, people that write books and you know, talk about the FBI being right there, in most cases, any kind of normal, localized crime that is not does not affect commerce, does not affect the U.S. interests. So your typical petty robbery, your assault cases, even murder. Really, we don't even get involved in murders. Domestic dispute murders. Anything that involves a local crime that doesn't cross or affect interstate commerce. We typically don't get involved. However, as I said before, we'll get involved if the local agency requests our assistance, or if there is a predicate violation that looks like it's being caused by a significant group of violent criminals, organized group, organized crime, that kind of stuff. So we kind of look into that kind of matter.
Right. So now some departments, like, for example, large metropolitan departments, I'm thinking like L.A. or New York, they'll have even their own organized crime units. So are you still going to be called in, though? Because I know also there's a whole matter of whether people get charged federally, sometimes meaning they're going to be kept locked up longer. So how would you still be called in if there's a major metropolitan, say, highly, we're not talking about out and out, you know, some place where there's an underfunded sheriff with one patrol car, but in a place like L.A. or New York where there's really a major law enforcement organization in place, is the FBI still getting involved there?
Absolutely. The LAPD and the New York Police Department, NYPD, some of these are the two of them, you know, the largest of the local agencies. Here in L.A., the L.A. County Sheriffs are enormous, and they all have some spectacular resources. New York PD is one of the few local police agencies that have representatives overseas to address terrorism matters. They've started up a number of counterterrorism centers, watch centers, fusion centers. They have spectacular resources. And, you know, to in any way put that aside as if the federal government's the only one that can make that happen would be ludicrous. They do a spectacular job on supporting a lot of these types of investigations, but we do it back in that collaborative effort thing. We provide agents and support staff members, our analysts, our terrorism analysts, drug analysts, our technicians, our technological support to a lot of these centers. So you'll see these crossovers between the local agencies and us in supporting a lot of these investigations. You'll see a mixture, whether it's our bomb squad, our bomb techs, we use our labs for all kinds of radiological signatures and patterns and, technological building of equipment used for investigations, transport and movement. A lot of stuff, you know, we share those resources. So, yeah, the short of it is, yes, we do share. But, I hate to say this because it's I don't want it to sound like this is the norm versus the anomaly, but in some ways, you know, law enforcement agencies are kind of like a gang. We're very territorial. We're very proud of our lines, of what we do and our heritage and our legacy. But I think there's a better, over, say, the past 20 years, we've done a lot better at trying to join ourselves into sharing each other's resources. Getting back to the stuff that we don't work, you know, when we talk about this collaborative effort, when you see like a murder investigation and you've got a case that's going on, the local authorities may be investigating that case, but they may call on us to use our evidence response team to come in and do the crime scene analysis so that we can do a little more than, say, for a smaller agency versus like an LAPD or an NYPD. But a lot of times their labs, Doug, as you can probably attest to, are booked up as well. They've got thousands and thousands of cases. And so the bureau can kind of shortcut that, circumvent around some of the stuff they've got going and getting it right to our lab in Quantico and get some stuff done faster than in some cases than what maybe a state can do. And then we pick it up under a fugitive, what we refer to as an 88 matter. We open a fugitive case, and then our agents will go out and start hunting these guys that are, whether the warrant's out for them or they're suspected of being involved in a crime. We can go after them for them, whether it be across state lines, or we can, you know, or international, which is really our strongest forte.
Good stuff. Well, I think we're about to come up on our break here, and we're going to take a little break, and then when we get back, we're going to talk about some jurisdictional stuff and some cases you might have worked on, and then talk about some other things that you're doing besides your past career.
Great.
So we'll be back shortly.
Everybody, after the break, we're on Science Radio again with your host, Roxanne Burke and Doug Lyle. Again, today's show is entitled FBI Agents, What Do These Guys Do, with special guest retired FBI agent, now director of security for ESPN, George Fong. And here we go, your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome back, everybody, and welcome back, George. John said, we're talking to retired Special Agent George Fong, who has a world of experience in the FBI, 27 years to be exact. And so, George, the next thing I want to ask you is, what are some of the fun, cool, interesting, famous cases that you got involved in that you can share with us without them coming and shooting you?
that would be a bad thing, wouldn't it? I'm very adverse to pain. A lot of us agents are, so we stay away from that. But I had some great cases, you know. And I, again, not to become a dinosaur, you know, when I talked about the agents that we referred to as dinosaurs, I became one, and it was really a kind of a happy, sad moment for us all, because we knew as we got closer to retirement, we were getting there. We made it. We couldn't get fired, right? I mean, we're going to make it to the end there. But in all seriousness, I mean, what we saw was a real change in the FBI since 9/11, and rightfully so on many occasions. But I think we kind of lost a little bit of our identity forced upon us to make this drastic change. When I got in back in 1983, the Bureau still did quite a bit of criminal investigations that we now have to reprioritize. And again, I don't want to get into all the details about the rights and wrongs of it all. Just to suffice to say is that I think that when I did get in the FBI and when I did get involved in some of these cases, it really made me reaffirm why I did what I did. I loved it. I loved being an agent. I'm very fiercely proud of being. To this day, I still do. I still carry my credentials as in my wallet, because it's just, I'm just so used to it. 27 years, you're just used to doing that. And some of the other agents, they still laugh at me about that. But, you know, secretly, they still carry theirs in their car, so they got nothing to complain about. But some of the cases, I mean, it's straight up criminal investigation. You're, you know, classic criminal cases, the whodunits. I have to say, one of the more mind-provoking and life-changing case I ever worked was a Kerry Stainer quadruple homicide in Yosemite back in 1999. Mm-hmm. That case was after, at that time, I had, I think, 16, 17 years in the FBI. I had worked undercover. I've taught overseas. I've worked major drug trafficking investigations, been involved in shootouts, I mean, everything, and yet I stepped into a case with about a dozen other agents and a dozen other agencies and got duped. And I don't know if there's a better way of putting it. You're out there trying to find these people that are missing, only to find out that they were murdered, and then now trying to find a killer. And there is nothing that puts a sense of urgency into you than to feel that you've got less time than you can ever think of before this guy commits another crime. And there's no sleep. There's nothing. You just go. You go straight through. I spent 6 months living in the woods chasing down anyone and everyone you can think of. Every lead you can have, all of us did. There were dozens of us looking for these guys. And we had the most critical component out of this whole thing falls in two categories. One is luck, and the other one is liars. And the luck part is Kerry Stainer left very little clue behind in his initial killings that we were able to track back on. He was very good at it. He got lucky at it we didn't find him. The second part is we had liars, and we had people that readily admitted to being involved in the murders that were not involved. Now, who admits to a murder that they didn't commit? I mean, it doesn't make any sense, but people do that. And, of course, you get everyone else in the world that wants to help out, and, you know, bless them all. They call and they drop tips about seeing your victims, hearing them, speaking to them, talking to them, when it really never actually existed. Why do people do that? And when it comes to writing, I think that makes it the interesting component about the characteristics of all these people as to why they do that. Not necessarily that they do it, but why. And so that case was really a moving time for me. And that kind of brought me into writing. But other cases, I mean, I was hired, I worked undercover for 8-9 years. I was hired as a hitman by a mob guy to kill his girlfriend's husband. You look at me, and I don't exactly look like a hit guy, but I just remember after meeting with the subject and speaking with him and trying to get him to admit to me that that's what he wanted me to do so I can charge him, it was a long process. I finally came home, and, you know, your wife says the kids are screaming, the wife's doing everything else, and she says, how was your day? And I said, well, you know, a guy hired me to kill somebody. And she's, that's good. Can you take out the garbage because it smells? I mean, that's where the absurdity of normalcy kind of falls into play. You kind of forget where normal is in a life. And in our household, normal is off the chart. And, you know, you don't realize that until it kind of hits you in the face. But it does bring you back into reality when you know that your responsibility really is to take out the garbage.
One way or the other.
Someday we should do a whole show on spouses of people in law enforcement.
We should.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
My wife wants to write a book on that, and she just, I don't know where to start. She says, all of the stupid things that you've done in your career. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, that's a good place to start right there, just all the stupid things I've done.
I'll be sure and tell her I'll help her with it.
No, but, you know, I've worked so many cases that that have been so interesting, dealing with state and local agencies. We had to deal with women and children brought into the United States for the purpose of prostitution. And the devastation of these people that come over here thinking that they can kind of come over here and work off their indebtedness through prostitution and have this fantasy that they can come and become have an American way of life, and only to find out that all they are now at this point can be as prostitutes, because if they're ever captured, they've got to go be deported. And I'd meet with these people. And so, you know, in the face value of things, when we talk about investigations, what you learn from that is the humanistic component of that. These people that really thought they were coming over here to have a good life in America.
Right.
And so you don't look at them as prostitutes. They truly are victims of all these people are taking advantage of them. And so, you know, you really do learn a lot more than just investigating cases when you get to meet these people.
Yeah, I sometimes think that a lot of things would be different if we looked at some of those people as vulnerable populations instead of just judging, you know, them or putting them in some kind of classification of low life or whatever. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, not to get off subject on that component, but, you know, taking that one step further, I worked on several murder cases where we arrested the killers. And I would go back and I would talk to the parents of these of the murderers. And you're talking with them, and you see this long stare, this distant stare of lost thought that all they're doing is they're just kind of a nonsensical mantra of statements that basically say, you know, where did I go wrong?
Right.
And you go like, who's the victim here? You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, someone died in this whole thing, but he has made more people victims than he can ever imagine for what he's done.
Right.
Yep.
Well, you know, I was just seeing earlier when you were talking about some of the cases you're in. In fact, you'd mentioned the Stanard case, which was in Yosemite, where you've got park rangers and other
right.
people. There are about 100, the last time I checked on a website, 100 agencies at the federal level that are in some ways law enforcement, investigation, custody, or have some kind of authority like that. So what does the FBI do that these other agencies don't? I'm thinking of things like the ATF, Homeland Security, U.S. Forest Rangers,
right.
NSA, all these, how do you guys stay out of each other's business?
I tell you, how we define ourselves? Cause we have a television show. Okay, so that beats everyone. They don't have a television show. Yeah. We all share jurisdictions on a lot of things. And, the FBI, of course, is far more notable than a lot of these agencies. No better, no worse than anyone else. Everyone has primary jurisdictions on particular violations. For example, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, they have primary jurisdiction on things like Title VIII violations, which are immigration violations. We also have that jurisdictional authority. But principally, they have first crack at the nut, I guess, is kind of how it works. And that's a very, very general. So if something happens, like, for example, on a federal national, the U.S. Forestry, they have jurisdiction to whatever goes on in there. But there are certain things that they're going to need help on. So we have memorandums of understandings between the agencies locally, all the way up through Congress, where we have primary. So they kind of divide that stuff up. Here's a good example, especially for writers, when we talk about these kind of things. There's always this conversation that goes back between staff. Now, the ATF is involved in a lot of gun trafficking, but in gun trafficking goes motorcycle gangs, organized crime, street gangs. And what do they typically sling? What's their major criminal activity? Drug trafficking. Guns are a part of that, but drugs are typically always a part of that component. And so you'll see the ATF purchasing, say, drugs in an undercover operation or investigating the case involving a Title 21 violation, which is drugs. ATF doesn't have authority in the Title 21 violation, but they still move forward because there's such an intertwine of criminal activity that you just can't say this one agency is going to be the one. Everyone's got to play in the sandbox. Everyone's got to participate together. Well, because ATF does not necessarily have the Title 21 or drug violation authority, they are hanging their hat on the fact that it is a violent group that's involved in guns, and they're going to be throwing everything on the plate here to put these guys in jail. And which goes back to the same issue as when people talk about drug trafficking and drugs. A lot of times you'll find a lot of gang members that will go and investigate cases, and we will charge them for mostly a drug trafficking violation. One, because they get good hammer time on that, and two, because it's typically the quickest and easiest way of neutralizing a threat gang or an organized crime group. But the underlying threat from that group could be murder, could be gun trafficking. And those are far more difficult to prove in a lot of cases. Witnesses won't testify. The witnesses is dead. The family members refuse to, for fear of retribution, to cooperate. So those things become a real problem. But if I can get them on a drug trafficking, I can probably put them away for just as long than I could for, say, a murder case. Does that give, closure for a family whose member had been killed? I don't know, and I couldn't tell you in all cases that that's the best answer. But if I get a guy off the street because he's killing people, I'm going to go after every violation that he's doing, and find the one that can put him away. Al Capone was the one.
I'm sure the families affected by Al Capone were just fine with having him put away on a tax.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And it's tax time, so always fear the IRS guy. That's the guy you always want to worry about.
I do. I think most Americans do.
Yeah. Well, we're the government. We're here to help. Just keep that. That's always our statement.
Well, I got a few more things I want to ask about jurisdictional stuff and task forces and all that. Before we run out of time, there's really a couple of things I want to know. I want to know how your FBI background helped you or hindered you in your job with ESPN. and how this same background led you into fiction writing and how you use that in your stories. So you have a new job and a new career that have spun off your FBI. How does that one help the other?
Well, I tell you, when we get all of us law enforcement guys, especially the federal guys, when we get close to retirement age, just so that you know, in the FBI, and we're referred to as 1811s. It's a government series that puts us in a category as federal law enforcement officers. We're mandated to retire at age 57. Without the director's approval, we must go at 57. We have the ability to go, at least today we do, to retire at 50, but must go at 57. So we start looking for a second career because we're still marketable. We still have these skill sets that give private companies an opportunity to say, hey, look, these guys have wonderful experiences they can bring aboard to help us protect our assets, our people, our company, things like that. So having said that, you know, when I got ready to retire, and I was after 27 years, I said, I think I've given my time to the government. It's time to move on. It was a very scary thing. And you look at, of course, the first thing you look at are security jobs. And I have to admit, in applying for the job and researching over some of the things that we do, it is nothing at all similar to what we did in life. The biggest issue that people don't realize is that in the government, as law enforcement officers, when we secure a location for a crime scene or protection or anything like that, our job is to keep everyone away. I mean, you have to prove to me you can come into this controlled area. In the private industry, my God, I want you in. I mean, here's a perfect example, Disneyland. There's no way I'm going to try to stop you and your three-year-old child to go, prove to me you need to be in here. I want you in here. I want to make this fan experience a great place. So this is where the FBI component comes in, law enforcement knowledge and experience. You've got to be creative in how do I get the company to say, bring these people in, make their experience to be wonderful, and at the same time, provide protection. So there's the intelligence component where I'm working with state and local agencies, federal partners on what are the threats, who's out there, who has some axe to grind with us, you know, social media. We search out social media looking for negative statements of people making threats or innuendos that they want to do harm to our company, our place of business, things like that. And then the buildup of the physical security of the locations, the people that we put into play to look for, watch for, check and modify everything that we do, the cameras that we have up on our closed-circuit TV to monitor all these things. It is a real creative process to protect you, the people, the spectators, the fans, the attendees that come to all of our events, and give them that feeling that they're welcomed rather than pushed away. So, it's a real creative component. I enjoy it because it gives me something different to look at and in a different light. And as I always say, in most cases, I always say when we deal with any of these games, when everyone gets all nutted up about something, I go, look, it's just a game. Nobody dies. Nobody gets kidnapped. It's a fun place to be at. So, yeah. So hopefully, under my watch, that's how I'll retire.
Cool. And your writing, how does that spin off of this?
Yeah, the writing's been great. And you guys have been phenomenal.
You have a book coming out, I know, very soon.
I do. In February, it's called Fragmented, and it's loosely based on a kidnapping case that I worked back in 1984. 85 in Washington, state of Washington. I was a rookie agent, and I was up there just, like, again, as I said earlier, I had no idea. I'm a new agent. I mean, what do I know about law enforcement? They hire all of us with these degrees, these knowledge, and these specialties, but the bottom line, like a Marine, right? Your MOS could be accounting or procurement or whatever, but if you're called upon, you pick up a rifle and you go to war. Well, in the I don't want to make it that dramatic, but in the FBI, you can have a lot of specialties. Bottom line is, you better know how to go out and investigate a case. And so we got pushed out, a bunch of us, new guys, a whole squad of all these new agents. We were young and just full of energy, without no experience. We just went out there and just attacked these cases, ate them up because we loved it. But we had a kidnapping case, and I kind of walked through this whole thing, and it really changed my perspective on people and life and how people how you react to everyone else. And I kind of carried that one all the way to the end. Well, fast forward to the Carrie Stainer case. After so many years of doing all these things and really feeling pretty confident about myself, I learned that no matter how much knowledge you have, you can still be beat. And that case proved that to me. It humbled me. And I was going through kind of a tough time back then after that case was over with, you know, I'd been gone from the family a lot. I'd been working these cases, and my wife was pretty much taking care of the house all alone. And you know what? I mean, she stood by everything. She was phenomenal. I decided that I needed some form of a means to kind of release all these things that were kind of floating in my head. And so I started writing, and I saw an article of a writer by the name of Robin Bursell, who you know very well.
Mm-hmm.
She was a cop, wonderful writer, and I just saw this article, so I sent her an email and said, listen, I've got all these great stories, but I want to learn the craft of writing. And sure enough, she wrote back and said, I'd love to meet with you. And so at that point on, it took off from there. She introduced me to some of the most interesting people I've ever met. I mean, between Michael Connelly and Lee Child and Don Winslow, you guys, the great people at Book Passage, all these wonderful writers. And, you know, you can tell because they're so, I mean, they're hungry to write that great novel. And they taught me that having the stories is a great component, but crafting that story is the key. And that is through character development. Procedurals are great, and I don't never want to pick on someone that writes procedural books. They're phenomenal. I eat them up as well. But I just, the fact that going through some of these cases where I'm not just going through the case, but I'm seeing these people and I'm understanding why they do what they do, or even worse, not understanding why they did what they did, is really the key component of what I was trying to find in my mind to put on paper. And so I started writing. And after, you know, like everyone else, dozens and dozens of rejections, you got to have thick skin. I finally found people that, like I said, worked with me, guys like Michael Connelly and Sheldon Siegel and Kirk Russell, to say, George, this is where it's at. I started just slicing down, just tightening things down, and finally got someone to listen. And so, it's been a great experience to write because it gives me an opportunity to put down on paper just the ideas that crossed my mind over those 27 years. Obviously, it's all fictional. I could never write nonfiction because I don't think I own the stories of someone else's tragedies. That doesn't belong to me. But the stories and what they meant to me do. And so, I'm carrying that forward. Yeah. And I love it. I just love the writing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that you've hit on something Doug and I try to talk to you people about a lot, which is that, especially with forensic science, you can get all kinds of forensic detail together. You can get procedure together, but that isn't going to put a heart into your story or make someone relate to your protagonist. So that's a great, great lesson.
That's right.
Too.
That's a great lesson. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
I love
about
it.
The science. It's about how the science affects the character.
Well, that is true. That is so true. I love picking up. I'll go to a bookstore, and I think writers, you all probably do this better than I do, but I'll go to a bookstore, and I love reading the first chapter of every book.
Yep.
Forget about
Right.
reading the whole book. I just grab it, and I look for that one that's going to grab me, that all of a sudden I become that person. I kind of feel like if I sit, it's like sitting in a roller coaster, and I don't want to guess who killed the person. I don't want to know who's the suspect of the case as much as I just want to sit in that cart and go on that track and just ride it all the way through. I would rather not know and read to the end because it's almost like a case to a certain degree. I get to let myself go and sit outside the box and say, just bring it on. Throw it all at me and let me take a look at it. And I think when you get that kind of a feeling from a book, especially off a mystery or a thriller, it really is like sitting on a roller coaster. You just want to go back one more time again.
I think also in this genre, which, you know, as you mentioned before, we have great collegiality in it as well. But I think there's that sense of the importance of justice and the importance of the individual that's really also part of investigating cases. I mean, we talked, you know, almost kind of alluded to that earlier when we were talking about those vulnerable populations. And I think Mike's Harry Bosch really, you know, embodies this, which is that idea that everybody counts or nobody counts, you know, that that there's a sense that we're going to stand in for the victim and find justice for them. And I don't know if that makes people, you know, of a certain kind be drawn to the genre or not, but, you know, that's sort of what you, I think, try to remember at the end of the day, that this is about, you know, finding justice for someone, and whether, you know, depending on where you are in the genre, you know, what kind of journey that is, you know, there's a big spectrum. But,
you know, how hokey that sounds to a certain degree when you kind of say it, you know, it sounds like a 1960s television show kind of thing, and you're waving the flag, but I'll tell you, there is nothing far more satisfying than to get that feeling after a case or doing something that's just so perfect for another person. It is the pinnacle of everything that we strive to do in our job, and you're a little embarrassed because you feel like, God, you know, that's kind of, you know, fantasy world, but it's not. It is a great feeling.
Well, George, this has been a fabulous show. I wish it was longer, and I really appreciate you being here. Jan and I both do. It's just, you know, we love you to death. We've known you for a while now, and I can't wait to read your book, and we'll do this again sometime. So,
absolutely. Well, thank you for having me. I truly appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate it. And I always say, remember to go check the websites, our blog, crimeandscienceradio.com, and, of course, the Suspense Radio site, my site, and you will find links to this show and the other archived shows that will come along. You will also have a lot of links to further reading for further study on these topics that we've talked about with George today. So everybody have a good night, and George, thanks again.
Great. Thank you for having me. Take care.